Yeah, I hadn't caught up, I see, and the red light's on, so we'll just...
There we go.
All right, why don't we just...
Today is August 31st.
Right, testing, 1, 2, 3, testing, August 30...
Okay, August 31st, Dr. Scully, and we still don't have our last transcript, but we're going to pick up with Special Children's Clinic until I can get that last one and see what, where we left off. You started at the, you started the Special Children's Clinic in...
The year I resigned as the dean, which was in the fall of 1979, I then took, the reason I resigned, I had surgery and I was recuperating, so I took several months of sick leave till the end of that year through November and December. Ernie Mazzaferri was appointed to acting dean by President Crowley. Then in January or February of 1980, it was in the winter of 1980, early on, Mr. DeCibio, who was the head of the state Health and Human Services, maybe in those days it was Health and Education and Welfare, like the federal HEW. Anyway, he called and said that he needed a physician to work at the Special Children's Clinic, which at that time was on California Road, right on the corner of California and Arlington, right behind the bank. It was in an old building on the second floor. And he wanted a physician who could come in a couple of days a week and examine the children and give a medical input. Most of the evaluations of children at Special Children's in those days were done by Joan Edwards, who was a psychologist, and people who were trained in speech pathology and audiology and physical therapy, because a lot of the children who were referred there, mostly preschool children, had one or another mental or physical disability. At any rate, since I was still on the faculty of the medical school and a member of the Department of Pediatrics, I said, sure, I'd be happy to do that. And so I called Bert Dudding, who was my chairman. I had hired Bert in 1978 to come and to start the Department of Pediatrics when our conversion was on. And he said, fine, that will help offset some of your salary. And I think we worked out a contract with the state health division that would pay, I'm guessing, 40% of my salary, and I would spend 2 days a week there, and they would pay the money to the medical school, and then that would, of course, go into my salary. So sometime in the late winter or early spring of 1980, I went and started working several half days a week evaluating children who were referred to the Special Children. They came from nurseries as young infants. They came from physicians, both pediatricians and general practitioners. They were referred by school and preschool programs. A variety of ways in which children would be sent to a state agency run by the state with the state and federal dollars, essentially to evaluate children who had any kind of disabilities. Well,
who was
DeCibio? DeCibio had at the time been working for the state government, and he was the director of the division of, I think it was called Health and Human Services. He subsequently left and went back to New Jersey, where he's from, and I think he was replaced actually by Larry Mathias, who then took the job for a few years.
So neither of those were... doctors?
No, they're both administrators.
Yeah.
They might have, I mean, they have degrees.
Yeah.
But they were administrators, essentially running state agencies. Mm-hmm. Then, sometime that summer or early fall of 80 into 81, they decided they were going to build a new Special Children's Clinic along with a Children's Behavioral Services Center right up behind the medical school. Mm-hmm. Off of Valley Road, and the state had property there, and in the matter of, I don't know, a year or so, and I was very fortunate to be asked my opinion about how that Special Children's Clinic ought to look, and had it my portion of the clinic designed so that I could bring students and residents. And one of my agreements with DeCibio and then subsequently with Larry Mathias when he took over the job was to be able to bring medical students and residents. Remember, at that time we had already started the third year clerkships, so we had clerks in pediatrics, and we already had started a pediatric residency, so we had residents in pediatrics. And so I would then, as a part of my faculty duties at the medical school in the Department of Pediatrics, would bring students and residents and sort of teach them how to evaluate children with disabilities and handicaps. And so they would be everything from children with seizures, children who were blind, children who were deaf, small preemies who had various birth defects of varying kinds. And basically the idea under what was then a federal law, trying to decide what educational and medical needs these children had, and to be sure particularly the ones whose parents didn't have much in the way of health insurance, to be sure that they got adequate medical care. Occasionally, rarely, one of those children would have to be institutionalized, but most of them, including a large population of Down syndrome children, I'm guessing maybe 15 or 20, would come to the clinic. In addition to being evaluated by this multidisciplinary team, they would also run a preschool there. And in the new building, which has now been in existence since the early 80s, they actually had play yards and they had preschools and they had programs where little infants could come and get help with the learning the basics of walking and crawling and climbing and speech and all that. So I've always been very supportive of the Special Children's Clinic, and I did that until I did it for another 2.5 years.
This was not any well baby clinic.
No, absolutely no well baby. They were none of that. That was done at the health department or elsewhere. These were all children who had special been screened by someone or other, by a public health nurse, by someone. And we also saw children who were victims of child abuse. It was really a mixed bag of problems, but they were all children who had been sent there by some health professional or some school or someone because they had a problem and they needed an interdisciplinary team to help them. So at the same time, when I also resigned as the dean, the Sierra Developmental Center, which in those days we called the Sparks Hospital for the Mentally Retarded, it was a state hospital over there, they needed a physician part-time. And so the director over there, who I know, called me and said, "I understand you've resigned and you're going to be working at Special Children's Clinic. Could you come over and give us maybe 2 or 3 hours a week to help, first of all, train our staff, nurses and psychologists, in the care of the mentally retarded?" These would be institutionalized children who live there. "And also take care of their medical needs," because a lot of them would have convulsions and seizures and need medication. Many of them would get ear infections or pneumonias. Some of them would have other health problems. So I said, sure. So actually, it turned out over the course of the next couple of years, about half my salary came from the state through Special Children's Clinic and through the Sierra Developmental Center, which was the in-hospital home for the mentally retarded. And my agreement there was also to bring students and residents, and I would take students over there. And so that and residents in pediatrics, and that would give them an experience with what it was like to be institutionalized. So then,
that was a whole range of ages, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, they were up to I would only care for those up to the age of like 21, and there would be another whole ward of adults who had been there for years.
With many Downs and
everything. PKU. Downs, children who years ago had had measles encephalitis or had had meningitis, or children who had had hydrocephalus and would operate on a variety of problems that 15, 20, 30 years before led to severe retardation long before we had much treatment for any of those things. So yes, I had patients who had been in the institution since they were infants or young children, and were there 15 and 20 years when I saw them. And that was their home. They had become wards of the state, either had been abandoned by their parents or turned over the state through a court order. So there was a lot of that. And
this must have been a wrenching experience.
Yeah.
You were so immersed in it.
I was. But I remember telling you earlier when I had been in medical school, going to that hospital for my OB experience in Albany, seeing for the first time children with hydrocephalus. But I think if you're in pediatrics, part of being a pediatrician is not just taking care of the healthy. Anybody can do that. Mothers can do that without you. But it's to help in the care of children with all sorts of special needs. And so it was part, I guess you'd say, of a pediatrician's duty, but also part of a pediatrician's skills and training. Now, there are a lot of physicians who do not like to care for the mentally retarded, and are not comfortable with it. And they're not comfortable dealing with the families who are suffering themselves. It's devastating for parents, or a whole family for that matter, to be told that they have a child who has a severe birth defect or a child who has severe mental retardation. And but I felt an aptitude for it, and I had a feeling for these children, and at any rate, I did it, and I enjoyed it, and I did it for about, I'm just keeping myself notes here off the record, I did that for about 2.5 years when I was approved for my sabbatical to go to the Hastings Center in New York to study medical ethics. So just as an aside, we can come back to that in a moment, from the summer of 1982, which would be about August, to July or June of 1983, I left those two jobs. I went on sabbatical to the Hastings Center in New York. Celia and I lived with her mother. Her mother lived in New Rochelle, where we were raised. And we stayed with her, and I would drive over each day to the Hastings Center. And my son and daughter-in-law stayed here in this house with one of the youngest, and they took care of the home. At any rate, for that year, when I was gone, Kay Walker, that was her name, Dr. Kay Walker, pretty sure that's her name, I can look it up, who had just finished her residency with us in pediatrics, took over those two positions and worked at the Special Children's Clinic and kept it going until I returned. Then in 1983, in June, when I finished my sabbatical, I returned to Reno, resumed my job. In the meantime, Kay had found herself a job in Oakland, where she wanted to be at the Children's Hospital. So I then went back to the Special Children's Clinic in the summer of 1983, and I did that up to a few months before my kidney transplant in the fall, in the spring of 1987. As a matter of fact, I would go there, I think, almost half-time for the next 3.5 years, and then when it was clear that I was going to, when I was going to have my kidney transplant, I was in renal failure, and I was going to be on sick leave for probably 6 months, which was in June of 1987. I resigned at the Special Children's Clinic, probably February or March of 87, and have never been back since. They then found, Joanna Fricke took over when I left, and she did it for several years, and they found several other physicians who would take care of these children. So I guess thinking about the actual timing, I probably worked at the Special Children's Clinic for about 6 years, probably from January of 1980 to the spring of 1987 with the 12-month hiatus in 82, 83 when I went on my sabbatical to New York.
You didn't go back to the state hospital or whatever you were.
No, that's good. When I came back, I did not do that. Matter of fact, I had found another doctor in town who was finishing his residency in internal medicine, I guess it was, and he was looking for some part-time work. And so when I left in 82 to go on my sabbatical, I recommended that he be hired. So I never went back to the Sierra Developmental Center, but I did come back and do special children's clinic. And then, of course, by then, I had returned from a sabbatical, and with Bert Dudding's approval, and subsequently his successor, Bert resigned as chairman of pediatrics in 83 or 4, maybe while I was on my sabbatical or shortly thereafter, and then Bob Bonar took over. At any rate, with their approval, I went on a part-time contract, and of course with the approval of Bob Daugherty, who was the dean by then, I went on a part-time contract so that I could spend a year with Celia here writing our book, Playing God. So when we returned from our sabbatical, we started working shortly after that on that book. And so I would go to Special Children's Clinic a couple of mornings a week. I would stay home a couple of mornings a week, and Celia and I would write literally together, side by side, in her study in there next to the computer. And then I would do my teaching obligations, and I would take care of the children in the clinic.
Did you implement any of the ethics training that you had?
Yes, we had.
At the medical school?
Yes, we did. And I'd have to look that up. When I came back from my sabbatical in June of 1983, the next year I put together, and I have most of the records, that I put together a curriculum in medical ethics which would be taught to the freshman and sophomore medical students. And as you know, at the university, you have to go through a lot of committees and starting new courses, and you have to have a outline and spell out the objectives and all that. So, in fact, I did that. And I think the next spring, maybe in spring of 84, the curriculum committee and the faculty and the dean, Bob Daugherty, and everybody concurred and approved putting in an ethics curriculum. And that next year we started, and I started doing it, I'm just guessing, I'd have to look it up, but maybe every other week for two semesters. Might have been maybe 6 or 7 two-hour sessions in the fall, and 6 or 7 two-hour sessions in the spring. It was for the sophomore medical students. The whole idea was to prepare them to be conversant with some of these ethical issues before they started their junior clerkships. And
what kind of training would they get for the layman who will be interested in this kind of thing? What kind of training would they get in ethics? Not that you get training, but what kind of exposure to?
Most of it, prior to actually seeing a patient, because they didn't see many patients in a medical setting until they were juniors, and we wanted to prepare for that. So what I did, and this has been done in many other schools in the country, what I did with the help of others was and taking from various textbooks and manuals that other medical schools had used, is develop about 15 case vignettes on paper. Fairly complicated vignettes which would address various ethical issues, for example, issues of abortion, issues of in vitro fertilization, issues of a withdrawal of life support, assisted suicide, euthanasia, issues of withholding information from patients, truth-telling, confidentiality. All these fairly important, excuse me, important ethical issues that they were likely to see in their third and fourth year and subsequently in their residencies, and we would put it, do it on a paper case, and they would be given the cases in advance after some introductory lectures and a syllabus that I gave them. They would be broken up into small groups, much like they do in other problem-solving sessions at the school, into small groups, and they would be expected to work out on paper their solution to whatever the problem was. And then they would come to class, and I would randomly call on them. I wanted everybody to be prepared. I would randomly call on them to stand up, some representative of the group, and describe what they considered to be the ethical issue in the case. Let's say withholding of life support, taking someone off of a ventilator and allowing them to die in an intensive care unit, for example. An emotionally difficult problem for any nurse or doctor to deal with. And what were the ethical issues involved, and how did they resolve those issues among their group? What conflicts did they have in their group? Who agreed and who disagreed with whatever the action would be? And then I would always force them to get off the fence and make a decision. What are you going to do? You can't sit around debating this for days. There's a patient dying there, or there's a patient in need of medication, or there's a patient or a family in need of support. So I'd force them to make an issue, and then I would challenge them, sort of in a Socratic way of teaching, challenge them, well, why would you do this instead of that? Why would you do A instead of B? And when it was all over, I would give them some copies of relevant literature or similar cases that had been discussed in the literature by experts. But I'd force them to deal with the problem before. So it was not a lecture course. I wasn't coming in giving them a set of answers, because in many of these issues there are not clear-cut answers. There are acceptable answers that society will accept, but they may not be clear-cut in all instances. So rather than come in and give them a lecture, you know, these are the conditions, these are the problems, this is how you deal with it, I would force them to use their own background, their own culture, their own religion, their own experience, their own gut feelings, and then give them something to read afterwards, which would have been written by someone who had dealt with this kind of problem, which is actually those shelves are filled with Hastings Center reports, which follow this format of teaching, where experts in the country will write in and discuss how they would confront such an issue. So anyway, that's what we did, and we're still doing it.
This was not a grade class, or grade?
No, it was just pass-fail, but they had to show up. They had to show up and participate, so it was required in that sense, but I didn't give them an ABC, if that's what you're asking. No, it was simply a pass-fail, and if you participated, that was sufficient to pass. Yep. That's what it amounted to. But the main thing is they had to show up.
With the different ethnic, cultural, religious mixes in these classes, did you have any?
Oh, some hot and heavy arguments.
Real surprises?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Very hot and heavy arguments, yes. And
how would those resolve? Because some people would know what was socially and medically acceptable, but maybe their own background would preclude coming to this kind of a decision. Maybe not a religious issue, but a cultural one.
Absolutely. And there were some of those rather hot and heavy arguments, and one of the principles of having an ethical discussion is permitting the other person to express their views and respecting their right to express them, although disagreeing vehemently with what their conclusion is. And the classic example of that is abortion. It splits every group down the middle.
Really?
Sure. And
that doesn't change, does it?
No, not really. And so,
Have you seen a change over the years?
Oh, somewhat, politically and legally, but I don't think there's a great change.
50 students.
Nah, nope. I think there's
still
those.
Still would be split.
Yeah. Uh huh. And
people who
right,
feel,
and there's a fair number who are uncomfortable since they're in medical school, acknowledging publicly their support of assisted suicide because they feel somehow that's against what the ethic of medicine is, but would confide to me privately, you know, I'm worried about this issue. So there were these kinds of conflicts, and I often said, well, come into the real world. Many of these are unresolved. There isn't a clear cut. You have to act in a way that is acceptable to you, but also acceptable to the patient. And the bottom line of such a conflict between patient and physician is the physician, of course, can never abandon their patient, but simply say, Mr. Smith or Mrs. Smith, I cannot acquiesce to your wishes. I can't do what you're asking me to do, and I'm going to have to refer you to some other physician who might, but I no longer can be your physician. A physician has has the right to be a conscientious objector and withdraw from the care of a patient if he or she is unable to deal with what the patient, just as the patient has every right to fire the physician and ask for another physician because the physician will not abide by their living will, for example, or will not abide by their power of attorney, or the patient wants an abortion and the physician won't do it, or the patient wants a large dose of morphine or other medications in order to overdose, and the physician is unwilling to participate in that kind of suicide attempt. So
this would really be their first exposure, wouldn't it?
On paper.
This kind of thing.
Well, unless they had had, for example, some philosophy or ethics course in college, they might have. Or if they had some personal experience. Some people have had such an experience with their own family member or a loved one, mm-hmm. dealing with, you know, taking grandpa off of a ventilator, or a sister who got pregnant and they had went through an abortion and it was disruptive to the family, or a child who is born with severe birth defects,
right.
and is institutionalized, or someone who a woman or a couple who want to go through in vitro fertilization to have a baby, and members of the family object on religious grounds. So these kinds of conflicts are not just simply, I'll say simply, but are not just doctor-patient. These conflicts, you know, revolve in a family, and they're in a society, but what I tried to do in the ethics curriculum, which we still do, I teach it every year, and I gave a class just last week, is to confront the student early on with these issues, at least as they appear on paper and in the newspaper. Now, quite different when they get to the hospital, and they have to personally deal with a patient or a family about an issue, and most of the time those revolve around when is it time not to resuscitate, when is it time to withdraw life support and allow the patient to die, those kinds of issues. How many times do you resuscitate a patient before you finally say this is futile treatment? Those are the kinds of issues, and later, you know, as we get into this further, if you want to see the actual outline, I'll give you an outline of the curriculum. And we've been doing that now, I think, I'll look it up, but I think that first time I did that was in 1984 or 85.
I would like to include an outline of that curriculum.
Sure.
Because I don't think that the average...
the kinds of issues that are brought up.
...person knows. We know what students... get in the way of anatomy and
right.
Physiology and that kind of thing. But
okay.
I think the ethics training, so to speak, it isn't training, but
no.
ethics, medical ethics exposure is something of interest to...
Okay, we can do that. Okay. Also, the other thing I did and have done ever since is when I returned from my sabbatical, I then began to participate with the ethics committees of the hospital. St. Mary's developed under Sister Damien with my help, and the VA developed an ethics committee, Washoe developed an ethics committee. Part of it came out of the Baby Doe conflict when the big baby doe issue was in the national scene, and Everett Koop was Surgeon General, and Reagan was president, and there was all of this concern by the federal government that somehow babies were being killed in nurseries, which was not the case, but that was the public perception, that they were being abandoned, allowed to starve to death, etc. Well, at that time, as a part of a federal program, actually a law, hospitals that were getting federal dollars were expected to have ethics committees established, and particularly ethics committees for the newborn nursery, and that's when I helped Sister Damien and John Brophy, I guess, was there at the time. Maybe Ken McLean was still in that job, I've forgotten, and a few others put together an ethics committee so that the neonatologist and parents and others who were dealing with a newborn that had severe disabilities or a newborn who had a lot of problems, there would be a group, sort of an outside, if you could say such a thing, quote, objective, end of quote, an objective group, could look at the ethical issues